This summer, the Adirondack Museum is host to an extraordinary traveling exhibit. Dreaming of Timbuktu tells the nearly forgotten story of free black New Yorkers who received land from abolitionist Gerrit Smith, settled in the High Peaks region of the Adirondacks before the Civil War, and established a community that came to be called Timbuktu. Timbuktu offered black settlers protection against anti-black prejudice, a means for living independently, and the possibility of suffrage. Tonight's lecture is the first in a series that will highlight varying aspects of this story. And I'd like to point you ahead to the coming lectures. On Thursday, July 19th, Dr. Carol Hunter of Earlham College will present a program entitled Germaine Logan and the Black Freedom Struggle. On Thursday, July 26th, Professor Milton Cernette's presentation will be North Star Shining, Tracking the Underground Railroad in Upstate New York. And finally, on Thursday, August 2nd, Dr. John Stauffer of Harvard University will present a lecture entitled Timbuktu and the Origins of an Integrated America. The exhibit Dreaming of Timbuktu and the companion lecture series were initiated by John Brown Lives, a grassroots freedom education and human rights project based in the Adirondacks, where the famed abolitionist wished to be buried. The goal of the project is the celebration of the freedom history of the region, the cultivation of public understanding of its significance in American society, and the revival of abolitionist commitment to racial justice. An independent scholar and author, Amy Godine is also the curator of Dreaming of Timbuktu. Amy Godine has been writing about social history in Northern New York since 1988. With Elizabeth Falwell, she co-authored Adirondack Odysseys, A Guide to Historic Places in Northern New York. A frequent contributor to Adirondack Life in the environmental magazine Orion, Ms. Godine teaches New York social history at Skidmore College's University Without Walls. Please join me in welcoming Amy Godine.
Thanks for coming, and thanks especially to the Adirondack Museum for its ongoing support of this project and the marvelous lecture series that goes with it. I hope some of you are planning to attend the other talks. John Brown Lives has lined up some terrific scholars, and while there's sure to be some repetition from one talk to the next, I think each of us approaches this rich subject from some radically divergent perspectives. I think each lecture will bring the news. Most of you, I think, I hope, are here because you've seen the exhibition, your interest is aroused, and you want to learn more about this subject than what I've managed to jam into the already overburdened exhibition text. We'll get there, but for you clueless few who stumbled in here thinking A Dream of Timbuktu had perhaps something to do with the Teddy Roosevelt safari gone awry, let me briefly set you straight. I'll be repeating a bit of what Susan already said. In 1846, a very wealthy upstate New York philanthropist and reformer, Gerrit Smith, began to give away what would amount to one-fifth of his half-a-million-acre fortune. Can you all hear me? Good. 120,000 acres in 40 to 60 acre lots. Most of this land was concentrated in the Adirondacks, and most of that Adirondack acreage comprised a sort of patchy north-south swath in townships 9 to 11 in Essex and Franklin counties. And let's get started. I can show some slides with this. There you go. There's Gerrit. As well as half of Township 3, or so, about half of Township 3 in Hamilton and Herkimer counties, which is south of Inlet. The 3,000 beneficiaries of Smith's largesse were black New Yorkers, urban people for the most part, though almost every county in the state would be represented by Smith's grantees. Smith's only requirements were that the grantees be poor, landless, absolutely sober, and between the ages of 21 and 60. Smith, who was a longtime and passionate agrarian, hoped fervently that his scheme of justice and benevolence, as he put it, would enable New York African Americans to make a break from city slums, rum shops, immigrant mobs, job discrimination and the like for a simpler, safer, more spiritually sustaining and self-sufficient life on small farms of their own. And though on this point Smith was somewhat less explicit, he also hoped the grantees would use their gifts of land to gain access to the vote. Let me explain. In 1821, the state legislature had slapped a prohibitive property requirement on New York's tiny black electorate that so reduced the number of black voters that by 1825, less than 300 of New York's black population of 30,000 were eligible for the ballot. And in New York City, where the black population was about 12,000, the number of qualified black voters had dropped to 16. This devastating blow to equal suffrage was reinstated yet again. Good, they're the right side, I'm so pleased. Was reinstated yet again in 1846, the year Smith gave away his land. Smith, who was a founder and sometimes a candidate of the anti-slavery Liberty Party, a zealous suffrage activist and a good friend to many black reformers, knew very well the demoralizing impact of the 1846 anti-suffrage vote on the black political intelligentsia. Giving black New Yorkers land enough to parlay into a vote was his answer to the disappointing 1846 referendum, a way of saying, hey, if they need land to vote, well, here it is. Let's get started. He never claimed that these 40-acre lots were worth any $250. They weren't. But with work and cultivation, or even if you didn't work it, even if you just paid your taxes on it and added it to your prior holdings, maybe it could be made to achieve a $250 value soon enough. I should add as well a point I didn't make in the exhibition, but I will here, that Smith was probably very happy to lose this land, some of which, according to the North Elba historian Mary McKenzie, he'd tried and failed to unload before. Smith's taxes were obviously enormous, and giving away unsalable land was as sensible a way to cut them as any. All of which is to rebut the popular conceit that Smith didn't know what he was doing, that only a lunatic could have devised such a harebrained, ill-considered scheme, a reading that gained some popularity with historians after Smith was admitted himself for a brief spell to the Utica Asylum following the capture of John Brown, and after Smith's somewhat problematic brief turn as a U.S. congressman. In fact, Smith's motives for his land disbursement project were quite sound. He could save himself some money. He could advance his own agrarian agenda. He could facilitate the ongoing effort to gain the vote for black New Yorkers. What he couldn't do was guarantee the project's success, and indeed, when it didn't fly, he promptly, wisely set his sights on other kinds of goals. As for that matter, did the farmer abolitionist John Brown and the many black agents who worked so hard to find grantees on Gerrit Smith's behalf. They all moved on to the next good thing, fighting the fugitive slave law, building an ever more efficient underground railroad, developing black schools, lobbying for the vote. This is a photograph you might have seen in the exhibit of the 1850 Fugitive Slave Convention in Cazenovia, New York, with representatives from both the black and white political reform communities. In the biographies of Gerrit Smith, Frederick Douglass, John Brown, or any of the many African-American reformers who helped get this land distribution effort launched, the whole effort to colonize the Adirondacks with black homesteaders takes up hardly any space at all, rarely more than a page or two. Hence the title of this exhibition, Dreaming of Timbuktu. Because for its originators, promoters, and beneficiaries, it was before and after everything a dream. Fewer than 200 black souls ever sampled Adirondack living as a result of Gerrit Smith's grand scheme, a pretty dismal showing out of 3,000 potential pioneers. Why it failed is a question I'll save for the end of this talk, but first let me return to the title, which promises you new findings. I wish I could report we'd found some things that stand the whole story on its head. Discoveries that show Gerrit Smith conceived the whole giveaway as an elaborate front for an Adirondack Underground Railroad. Now, wouldn't that be juicy? Or that Brown did indeed spirit numberless fugitive slaves to Canada. Or that Smith really intended these grants for fugitives, as idly rumored by numberless Adirondack historians. Or a map, that we found a map with a little colony called Timbuktu actually spelled out on it so we could see exactly where it really was and once and for all lay to rest the burning debate about how it's spelled, John Brown's way with one O or his son's way with two. no can do. What's new about our story has less to do with brilliant new findings than with a generous new frame for the story that shows it in a light that makes more sense of it. Not new findings so much as a new configuration, a fresh perspective, a corrective to the fact, for instance, that a century of published Adirondack history has utterly ignored the central issue of political suffrage and the meaning of land ownership in terms of the ballot. That in all the chapters on John Brown's brief tenure at North Elba, no historian or regional writer has ever noted or acknowledged the critical role of the 10 or so black downstate or central New York reformers who went to bat for Gerrit Smith, rounding up the names of eligible grantees from 1846 to 49. In my view, Smith's behind-the-scenes apostles were simply the most accomplished, politically informed set of real estate middlemen ever to assist in the peddling of the Adirondack region, and no surprise considering Gerrit Smith's connections. His civil rights work had put him at the bullseye of a wide web of radical abolitionists, black and white, from all over New York State, and when Smith needed help, he knew just who to ask. Men of influence and spiritual standing, like the slave-born orator Reverend Henry Highland Garnett of Troy, famous for his blunt advocacy of an armed rebellion against slavery, or Reverend Jermaine Wesley Logan of Central New York, who helped more than 1,000 slaves or fugitives find their way to freedom, gaining for Syracuse a reputation as the Canada of the North, of the United States. Or from New York City, Dr. James McCune Smith, the first degree-holding black doctor in New York, physician in residence at the Colored Orphans Asylum in Manhattan, anti-slavery lecturer, essayist, advocate of children's and women's rights. Princeton graduate, Reverend Theodore S. Wright, first black American graduate of a theological seminary who blazoned the abolitionist cause at the pulpit of the influential First Colored Presbyterian Church in Manhattan, Elder Charles Bennett Ray, minister, editor of the Colored American, and overtaxed station master for New York's Underground Railway. To borrow a line from the exhibit, these men agreed to help out a rich white country philanthropist, not for sentimental reasons, though they liked and admired Gerrit Smith very much, nor for compensation, there wasn't any, but from their own long-standing agrarian idealism, their weariness with urban life, and their conviction that the black vote was more effectively pursued in the country than in the city. But this whole angle, and it is substantial, is missing from the regional canon. Look in vain in the Adirondack readers and anthologies, old and new, for Frederick Douglass on the Adirondacks. Yes, he too was a grantee. Or Dr. McCune Smith's good-natured account of getting lost in the woods when he visited North Elba in 1849, or Reverend Logan's terse account in the North Star of his 7-week tour of the region and what he heard about unscrupulous Adirondack guides who were duping the grantees. Logan also noted in his letter 10 or so white Adirondacks who were white Adirondackers who were pointedly sympathetic to the newly arrived black grantees. A magnificent clue for us, hinting at some quiet grassroots links between downstate African-American activists and the rural anti-slavery reformers up here. Armed with these names, a crew of us, Greg Furness, Mary Ho Tayling, Shirley Morgan, and Susie Doolittle, and Martha, and me, started researching their stories. Who were they? What were their religious affiliations? Where were their farms? Who were their kin? We've got a long way to go with this end of our research, and who knows, what we find might fuel another exhibition, one that focuses on the rural abolitionist activities of men like the North Country newspaper publisher Wendell Lansing, who was said to have spirited fugitives in and out of his Keysville and Wilmington homes in high-sided charcoal wagons. Or Jedediah Merrill, a settler, surveyor, innkeeper in the hamlet called Merrillsville today, who not only offered to assist the grantees find their land, but went so far, thank you Mary Ho Tayling for this picture, but went so far as to personally endorse the quality of Smith's land in a letter to a black newspaper in Syracuse, again, evidence of a more immediate black-white connection than we'd ever supposed. Or Stephen Keyes Smith, a Quaker abolitionist from Peru, very active in the Underground Railroad, who hauled his bride across the Adirondacks clear to Utica to hear Gerrit Smith address a Liberty Party throng. Some of Logan's names cropped up in the pages of a short-lived Liberty Party newspaper, the Herald of Freedom, out of Moores, just west of Plattsburgh. I'm sorry it's so wretched, but this is as good as it gets. This is up in the SUNY Plattsburgh Library. It's the only copy of this newspaper, but it's quite a find to discover an abolitionist newspaper in the North Country that we can still look at. Over and again, Smith emerges, Gerrit Smith, as the linchpin who yoked together abolitionists black and white, the one who undoubtedly gave Logan the names of sympathetic Adirondack abolitionists in the first place. I don't think Smith visited this region more than once, and that was a cruise up Lake Champlain to stump for the Liberty Party in 1845, not a foray into the interior. But his affinity for northern New York was profound, and it's easy to see why. If in 1846, don't even try to read this, I'll just tell you what it is. If in 1846 New York City voters emphatically rejected equal suffrage, northern New York voters were all for it. Franklin, Clinton, and Essex counties topped the state in 1846 in pro-suffrage ballots. This is the reckoning from Clinton County votes and 46 on the suffrage issue and on Liberty Party candidates. And Clinton County leads the state of New York in votes cast in favor of black suffrage, which is quite remarkable. Second to that is Essex County. And all the Adirondack counties come up pretty high on that list. It's pretty fascinating. Quaker settlements on both sides of Lake Champlain were actively engaged in the Underground Railroad. The Herald of Freedom, which you saw before, was distributed in villages as small and remote as Jay, Ausable Forks, Wilmington. The Liberty Party got vote in all these little towns, not very many, but enough to indicate the presence of a number of committed abolitionist households. And where the Liberty Party had a toehold, we have to think of Gerrit Smith. It was his money that funded the abolitionist libraries and small anti-slavery communities or households that underwrote the abolitionist newspapers, black and white, around the state. His influence was felt then not just among black reformers from Troy, Syracuse, Rochester, Elmira, Manhattan, but among white abolitionists in tiny all-white Adirondack hamlets as well. I alluded to the Underground Railroad. Very hot subject these days. Lots of plaques going up and lots of grant money funding the New York Freedom Trail and other URR initiatives. We didn't get into this in the exhibit. It simply wasn't in the line of fire of our research. But if I were to undertake a research project on these lines, I think I'd start not so much with notoriously hard-to-document, self-serving, myth-endorsing family histories of hidden cellars, trick closets, secret passageways, and so on, but with a paper trail of political affiliations, meetings, newspaper subscriptions, letters to the editor, poll counts, and the like. This is a letter from Jedediah Merrill, white Adirondack pioneer frontiersman, to a black newspaper in Syracuse. Who subscribed to the abolitionist newspapers from the region? Who was the local Liberty Party delegate who went to the big conventions in Utica or Troy? This is the kind of stuff that tells me who was really paying close attention to the anti-slavery debate and reveals just how widespread was the ideological net that got Gerrit Smith to thinking the Adirondacks might make fertile ground for his great scheme. Long-beloved small-town rumors of this or that station on the URR makes more dramatic copy, but give me a subscription list to an Adirondack newspaper any day. It's a lot easier to make a case that the hidden cellar in your 1850 farmhouse sheltered fugitives as well as turnips if I know its antebellum owner read the Herald of Freedom from Moores or the Ram's Horn from Brooklyn. There wasn't room in this exhibition to do more than hint at our findings about the local Adirondack abolitionist scene, but at least we flagged them and were able to hint as well at another neat packet of research, namely the stories of the settlers whose biographies, I believe, have been as carelessly depoliticized by regional historians as Gerrit Smith's. From census reports and the invaluable research of local historians like Ed Cotter, Mary McKenzie, and Maurice O'Brien, we learned a fair amount about the black settlers' Adirondack lives, where they settled, what kind of crops they grew, how much their cabins were worth, in what towns or cities were they born. But there's another side to their stories you can't find in local records. You have to get outside the box, as it were. Stretch your frame of reference to reach beyond the region to the centers of Black influence and look for your clues there. Take, for instance, the settler James Henderson of Troy, who gained some notoriety among Adirondack historians for having had the bad luck to get caught in a blizzard and die of exposure after farming here a few years. In an 1888 account of Timbuktu by the eminent Adirondack photographer Seneca Ray Stoddard, Henderson, unnamed, is just that, quote, old nigga who froze to death, emblematic of the hapless grantees who, quote, want much use to work and couldn't stand the kind they got here. Well, that's his version. But far from the Adirondacks, in Black newspapers and in Garrett Smith's correspondence, we meet another Henderson altogether. This one, before he froze to death, owned a shoe store in Manhattan, ran a night school for adults, worked for suffrage reform at Black political conventions in Schenectady and Troy, and was the first settler in his township to hang out a professional shingle as a cobbler. He also served as North Elba's inspector of elections and wrote of his Adirondack land to readers of Frederick Douglass's The North Star in 1849. There is no better land for grain. We get from 25 to 50 cents, 50 bushels of oats to an acre. The farmers here get 56 cents per bushel, cash in hand, for their oats. So much for the hard, dying myth of the indolent, fish-out-of-water Garrett Smith grantee. Or take William Carasaw. In his influential chapter on John Brown and the colony called Timbuktu, the regional historian Alfred Donaldson wrote in 1921 that Black settlers in the Adirondacks were about as sensible a fit as, quote, an Italian lizard on a Norwegian iceberg. Yet here is a settler who enlists in the Union Army during the Civil War alongside his white townsmen from here, who only a few years after his arrival in North Elba is matching his most productive white neighbors barrel for the output of market-bound maple sugar. And I owe Frankie Gabriel, a student of mine, for scaring up this long-lost, oh, this isn't him, hold on, there he is, long-lost image of Carasaw in the Watervliet Arsenal archives, where it has languished for the past 150 years. It's quite thrilling to find a photograph, just our third, of a Smith grantee who actually settled here. There isn't a lot of visual material to work with, as you know. William Apo, I don't have a picture of, but I want to mention him too in this context. Not a grantee, not even a New Yorker, a Black freeborn Philadelphia professional musician for Frank Johnson, then the most prominent Black band leader in the country. Apo buys his land from Garrett Smith, doesn't get it free, and sets himself up as a sort of seasonal gentleman farmer and music teacher, moving to North Elba full-time only in his retirement. Son enlists from North Elba with the colored troops, dies at Bull Run. A local historian had warned me firmly not to get his story mixed up with Timbuktu. He had nothing in common with the grantee homesteaders. She has insisted culturally and socially they were galaxies apart, and she has a point. But there's another point of commonality her references ignore. There is a world of shared political conviction, and here Apo and the Black grantees appear to have found common ground. His name and the names of men who would later move to Timbuktu all crop up on the same short list of officers or delegates at a suffrage convention in Troy in 1845. It's a small clue, but a vital one. It locates Apo, for 1 year anyway, in a city that was a veritable hotbed of anti-slavery activity, thanks to Reverend Garnett. It suggests also how Apo learned of Smith's project in the first place. He knew Garnett. He had Troy acquaintances who later moved to Essex County. One last example along these lines. Lyman Epps, Timbuktu's best-known settler and beloved pioneer, who just may have cut the first trail through Indian Pass and whose family stayed in the region for a century. In numberless sentimental accounts of John Brown's funeral and commemorative services that follow, this farmer and Adirondack guide invariably figures as the faithful acolyte who serenades his old mentor with the hymn, Blow ye the trumpets, blow. Blow ye the trumpet, blow. Nothing wrong with this except, like the story of Timbuktu itself, it means that Epps is always basking in the reflected glory of John Brown. But I found evidence of a different Epps, vigorous and angry. In 1854, this is the one picture we have of him that I'm aware of, Epps wrote a long letter to Frederick Douglass's paper, a response to a forthcoming, quote, contemplated celebration to come off in North Elba in honor of Gerrit Smith's benevolence in the matter of lands donated to our colored brethren. And in this letter, Epps is riled. Forget the, quote, vain show and empty declamation, he writes. What's to celebrate? Where are the settlers? And where are the agents who are supposed to be making sure the settlers don't lose their land to taxes? Quote, as the demand for lumber increases and as the supply is becoming scarce, these lands are rapidly increasing in value, Epps explained. A few years since, lumber contractors could get standard logs delivered on the banks of the Saranac for 34 cents apiece. Now the same command 9 shillings. Within a year or so past, large tracts of these lands, some most probably belonging to those gentlemen who would celebrate the grant, have been sold for taxes. And if not redeemed within 2 years from the day of sale, those who bid them in will realize from what they term nigger lands handsome fortunes. It appears to me, Mr. Editor, Epps writes acidly, that were the grantees apprised of the fact that these lands are very valuable and still increasing in value, they would certainly redeem them. Implicit in Epps' analysis is a tough rebuke to Gerrit Smith's agents who had given up promoting the disbursements by 1854. I, for one, welcomed the tough-talking Epps who laid to rest once and for all for me the hymn-singing, hat-holding cliché that lives only in the shadow of John Brown. And what about John Brown? Frankly, if it weren't for his attempted seizure of Harper's Ferry, his capture, trial, and execution, Brown's modest farmhouse in North Elba would almost certainly not be on our map. And if it weren't for the years his family lived here, we'd know a lot less about Timbuktu and the Gerrit Smith disbursements than we do. Every Adirondack history, from Nathaniel Sylvester to Paul Schneider, finds the story of Timbuktu by way of the martyr's saga of John Brown. Tens of thousands of readers of Russell Banks' novel Cloud Splitter only know about a black settlement in the Adirondacks because of a prior interest in John Brown that drew them to Banks' book. So yes, we owe him, big time, but we don't start with him. We don't even start with Gerrit Smith. We start with the forces that inspired Gerrit Smith to hatch this plan in the first place, with racist legislation that long preceded John Brown's removal to these parts, with living conditions for urban black New Yorkers, riots, joblessness, and so on. Not a new finding, perhaps, but a way to frame the story that for many may amount to a new finding, and that's good enough for me. This, incidentally, is not how we originally planned it. Martha was pushing for kicking it off with John Brown, and I was talking up Gerrit Smith. Then we thought, forget Smith, let's kick off with those little-known black abolitionists who actually hit the streets and got the names. But the more we dug into the black press, convention minutes, early letters, the more we realized that our starting point had to be more general, more descriptive of a situation that got Smith going and that moved the agents to drop their work and get on board. A situation in 1846 of such rampant racism, such a crude and terrible denial of civil rights, lost jobs, evictions, bounty hunters, and so on, that Gerrit Smith had no choice but to come up with a plan as drastic as the conditions that inspired it. Not a new finding, as I say, but a shift in emphasis, which is long overdue. And now we come to why Timbuktu failed. New findings, some, but again, more of an enlarged context that frames an explanation in a better, bolder light. We've already heard from Alfred Donaldson, who argued that the grantees, runaway slaves, he said, just weren't up to the rigors of the Adirondack winter, and the whole project was a crazy mismatch born of a political naïf's magical thinking. If this reading has enjoyed such a long life, it may be because it dovetails so neatly with other archetypal Adirondack sagas of rich guys screwing up, harpy land barons getting their deserved comeuppance when they're up against the reality check of the Adirondack frontier. Let's retire that once and for all. Smith was not a Will Gilliland or a Harrishoff or a Morehouse, the man who advertised for these lands who wound up in an insane asylum, just as Harrishoff wound up killing himself and Gilliland wound up dying in the woods of exposure. He never sought to turn a profit. He never aimed to make a fiefdom, and the grantees weren't fugitives on the lam, though many of them were born into slavery and had escaped or been emancipated years before they took up living in New York. Neither were they, as so many writers have implied, incompetents or Smith's hapless dupes. They were undercapitalized, underguided, radically inexperienced. The know-how, tools, livestock, seeds, or capital that their Yankee neighbors brought to these woods was not their legacy. They were city people with city skills. Gerrit Smith had promised them a mentor, a sympathetic white farmer named John Brown, but he came late to the scene and was, for all his considerable help, far from the on-site, ongoing presence Smith had envisioned. And even if John Brown had come, that's a hard slide to see. It's called Building a Log Cabin. It's obvious, I guess. Even if John Brown had come, and even if they'd been experienced, it wouldn't change the fact that so much of the land Smith gave away was lousy. Underwater, on steep, rocky hills, in remote portions of the wilderness, inaccessible by wagon road or even footpath. It wouldn't soften the rumors of double-dealing local guides leading grantees to the wrong lot, or reports of local storekeepers who were overcharging settlers for supplies, or duplicitous surveyors. It wouldn't mollify white Adirondackers who feared, this according to one early local history, that the black newcomers would overwhelm white voters at the polls and impose their own political agenda, whatever they imagine this to be. And as all of these stories, true or false, drifted downstate with each returning settler, who can blame the grantees for losing interest? The project was troubled by another credibility problem as well. This is a hard one to document, but to me it adds up. None of Smith's agents, not one of these erudite, charismatic, cultivated men, all of whom got land in the Adirondacks, ever chose to settle on his grant. Some of them considered moving. Dr. McCune Smith even wrote Gerrit Smith asking that his hillside acres be exchanged for something a tad more arable, or at least accessible. But he stayed put in Manhattan in the end. They all did. When Dr. Smith was writing Gerrit Smith, he was dealing, he wrote, with an orphanage full of children devastated by a measles epidemic. How could he walk out on this? Charles Bennett Ray and Germaine Logan had thousands of fugitives to help to freedom. Garnett had his anti-slavery work in Troy and New York City. These were very busy, engaged men, and none of them, for all the high-flown agrarian rhetoric, could see trading in their proven effectiveness at their important work in the city for the dubious pleasures of the plow. And say they were prepared to lead by example. That's the Colored Orphans Asylum on Fifth Avenue, where McCune Smith volunteered as the doctor for the children. Say they were prepared to lead by example, who would follow? Most black New Yorkers couldn't read or write, and in any case could not afford to buy the black newspapers whose editorials promoted the Smith lands. Frederick Douglass could pen 100 glowing columns about the glories of the Adirondack wilderness. So what? Most of his readers were white. Charles Ray could sing the praises of the farmer's life at national black conventions, but who was listening? Firing up those delegates was preaching to the converted. The insularity of the black political intelligentsia, its condescension for black vernacular culture, its impatience with city life and black neighborhoods, its censure of alcohol, its unease with so-called Africanisms in church, all this weakened its potential influence and curbed its reach. This is a flyer. I wonder if this focuses more. It's a flyer that Charles Ray and McCune Smith put in black papers in, I think it's 1854, to urge the grantees to pay taxes on their land. For all I know, I haven't checked out the timing in this, but it might have been an embarrassed response to Lyman Epps's letter, which would be interesting to find out. I don't want to undermine the feat of rustling up 3,000 signatures in just a few years' time, which the agents did, but getting the bodies to back the signatures, or even just to claim their deeds, or keep up with the taxes to retain the land, this is what Lyman Epps was talking about, and where he saw the agents falling short. Yet how could Reverend Logan persuade a working man like Joseph James, an iron ore bloomer from Westport, who got a Gerrit Smith grant, to move to his new lot in Essex County when he already had a solid job in the company town of Merriam's Forge? What could Elder Charles Ray possibly say to Jonathan Mingo from Flushing to make him feel better about his Adirondack grant? Mingo was no fool. He was a farmer. He'd visited his land, and he was underwhelmed. Wound up moving to Albion, Michigan, and did so well, he got a street named after him, which was Michigan's gain and the Adirondack's loss. Signing up for land was easy. The grantees stood only to win. But moving there, trading in the security and solace of a black neighborhood, however battered, however bleak, for the social and economic uncertainty of the all-white frontier, this was asking more of the grantees than perhaps the agents understood. It was a class conflict, and it hurt. When Gerrit Smith and the black reformers looked at cities, all they saw were rum shops, brothels, jobless men, bounty hunters, kids who couldn't spell or read. They never acknowledged, or maybe they just didn't get, the positive uses of community, the value of the neighborhood, the human need for something known and familiar and safe. It seemed never to occur to them that the settlers might get homesick, lonely. Their own class bias, I think, had maybe blinded them to the human needs of the metropolitan grantees. Then, in 1850, with the passage of a federal fugitive slave law that puts every New York African American, free or fugitive, urban or rural, at risk of being captured and sold into slavery, that loneliness is joined by fear. And the progress of the Smith Land settlement, already slowing, grinds to a halt. Who wants to move to a region where African Americans are so few and every white stranger may turn out to be a bounty hunter? Cities at least provide safety in numbers. The Adirondacks offered no such retreat. If you have to flee, flee to Canada. Do it right. In regional accounts of Timbuktu, there is no mention of the effect of the fugitive slave law. No mention of the property requirement legislation of 1821 and 1846. No mention of the visits to the region by leading black reformers, of the imaging of the Adirondacks in the black press. No mention of the 2,800 grantees who didn't come to the region, their discreet and remarkable stories, the numberless uses of Gerrit Smith's ledger of 3,000 names as a window into the lives and worlds and stories of everyday black New Yorkers in 1846. Why are these things missing? The omissions aren't willful or mean-spirited, but they do reflect a dangerously parochial belief that local history should have only to do with local people, places, and events. Timbuktu is a local story, but it's a tale tied as well to Albany and Syracuse and Brooklyn and Elmira. It is buoyed along by political conventions in Troy and Utica and buffeted by legislation out of Washington. Again, not new findings, these, so much as a fresh context, a wider perspective, a bigger frame. It's the difference between a lazy joke about a lizard and an iceberg and a complicated, rich saga of a worthy dream of equal rights that got people thinking about the Adirondacks in a way they never had before, that unleashed a stream of rhetoric as radical as it was refreshing, that brought together white and black civil rights reformers from downstate and the sticks, emboldened the civil rights movement in a particularly dark hour, and not least enabled numberless black New Yorkers to pursue the franchise, whether or not they ever settled on their Adirondack land. That's it. I did it in 45 minutes on the nose.